You ready?
Ready.
Ready?
Ready.
Ready?
Do it.
Okay, here we go.
Yep.
Good evening, folks. It's Paul and Grace.
Yes, I'm here too.
And this is the podcast for February
3rd.
Well, tomorrow's the 4th.
February 4th.
2018.
Fine.
And we're getting it recorded a day early.
Woohoo!
So we're way ahead of the game.
Ahead of the game here, guys. Yeah. Except now that we're doing this, we don't have a walk to talk about.
We don't have a walk to talk about because we usually walk on Sundays.
Yeah, and then record after the walk. But you know, this is actually not a good weekend for walking.
Not really.
No, it's cold and windy and occasional
snow showers.
So
yeah,
it's
and also. My knee is kind of messed up.
Oh, that's right. It's not really. You don't really want to put too much work on it.
Like I'm that. Not supposed to. I'm supposed to rice it.
Supposed to rice it for how long?
Another week, I guess.
So,
and then
it's probably no walks for a little bit, guys.
Yeah. So I had this
incident.
I had this little incident where I was driving home, and I. Did as I usually do, which is stop the car and got out to get the mail before I then get back in the car and turn down our little driveway off Crane.
Yeah.
And somehow as I did this, I failed to put the car in park.
Yeah.
And so it was also icy.
Yeah. Slippery, slidey.
And so I had a strange combination of I'm stepping out of the car to get the mail. My foot slips on the ice, and the car starts rolling away from me.
Which is, you know, comic.
And
but dangerous.
Yeah. So somehow, in all that, my right leg was still inside the car, kind of still actually wedged under the steering wheel. And I fell and torqued my leg with quite a bit of force.
Yeah.
And it hurt a lot then.
Yeah.
And I was actually worried that I had broken something.
Something somehow, right.
Then. But it started to feel better pretty quickly.
Yeah. The swelling was not bad. It was a little bruised, actually.
Yeah, a little bruised, a little swollen. And I thought, okay, well, it's not really broken. I'll just keep an eye on it. You know, it could be a tiny fracture or something. But then
fast forward a week,
and then last Sunday we went out walking, mm-hmm. and I for part of that walk I carried Benjamin on my back for
maybe 75% of it.
Yeah, and maybe for 2 miles or so. I don't know.
It was for
a long while, and he weighs 40 pounds.
Yeah,
and my knee wasn't completely healed, and then that you know even if I hadn't been injured at all, that would have made me sore.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
But it was then really sore. It
really, really painful. Yeah.
And then I didn't do anything about it. I was like, oh, I don't want to go because if it is broken, they're going to do all this
stuff.
It's going to take forever. I'm going to have to wait forever. But I finally went to an urgent care clinic, mm-hmm. and they did take an x-ray and examine it. And they say that there's not a break.
Yeah.
So. I looked at the x-rays. I'll say that there's no blatant
no obvious break.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. But I'm having a slight dispute with the radiologist. I think there's actually a hairline crack in the head of the tibia.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But I can't, you know, I'm not qualified to say for sure, but I saw it on the x-ray.
Right,
and then it's also visibly swollen.
Visibly swollen, but I think here's the thing though:
the treatment's the same.
Yeah,
it's not. So I mean, it's already partially healed if it is a crack. So it's just ice and anti-inflammatories and trying to stay off it. And wrap it.
Yeah.
So yeah, rice.
Rice it up.
So that's what I'm doing. So I probably wouldn't want to go for a walk tomorrow anyway.
Anyway, even in you know, good winter weather.
Yeah.
And now, mind you, personally, I'd be all about a winter walk in light snow.
in a winter wonderland.
Yeah. My kids, however, would be less enthusiastic.
Oh, the snow is blowing in my eyes. I can't stand
it. This is my hair. I'm all wet.
Yeah, that'll happen.
Yeah, so, yeah, we're not going to go there.
So, yeah, probably we're not going to have a walk this week. So,
that's the sad part. Are we reading anything? Is anything going on like that?
I'm continuing to read this long, rambling novel called Is There Any Other Kind That I Read? Yes. Called Existence by David Brin. Mm. He's a science fiction author. He's best known for the Uplift books, which won Hugo and Nebula Awards. He's award-winning. But this novel is like almost 1,000 pages, and it's really rambling, and it reads like...
Telephone book in Elvish?
Not exactly. Oh, okay. It's like it's kind of become... He's kind of a futurist, so he's follows all these trends.
Right.
But in this book, he didn't turn them into like a novel.
Right.
And so he keeps dropping into notes from some future thing, which is like some future version of Wikipedia or something. And so places in the book... Clearly, he was working in some kind of outliner program. Like, there are these programs for novelists. These, like, writing tools for novelists that let you link in all your notes, and they're all hyperlinked together.
Right.
And I think somehow he exported the text into Microsoft Word or whatever. And
it just got printed.
It just got printed because there are hyperlinks in the text. Like, what? There are places in these... In like these encyclopedia entry things where certain terms have dotted underlines, like very faint dotted underlines, like they were a blue hyperlink or something.
Well, maybe that's supposed to bring realism to the text, like they're actually reading the page?
It's only in a few places, so I think it's actually a mistake. Yeah. But it's like three... The other thing he does is this kind of thing that's still trendy, and I wish the trend would just die, which is you write three novels, and then you chop them up and interleave them to make a really long book.
One long book.
Right, and the characters, maybe they meet up, maybe they don't, but they're connected by events or something going on. And so it's the length of three novels, honestly.
Because that's better.
Yeah, and then and one of them... God help me.
God help me.
God help me. one of them is the basically an Uplift series book, and halfway through the thing, and now I'm in a chapter where the protagonists of the chapter, not the whole arc, are sentient dolphins.
Oh.
And they're...
Are they talking?
They're talking to each other, and they're transcribing it. And this is something, actually, that I just kind of loathe in science fiction, is anthropomorphized animals.
How are the dolphins transcribing?
Who's taking notes?
Who's taking notes?
Their notepads would be all soggy.
What? Are they doing nose taps on a computer?
You know what? I didn't even think of that because just the thing itself is so annoying that I didn't even think about that.
I'm just, you know.
I mean, that's just, but you know, most, in a lot of novels there, a lot of, so the modern sort of trend in, I guess, narrative voice is like what's called a free indirect, where the narrative perspective just kind of wanders around in and out of characters' heads. And that's become so common that I don't even, like, notice it anymore.
That seems like a terrible idea.
It's very common where you'll get inside a character's head and then the narrative will go off and recount a bunch of facts and a bunch of things that are going on in the physical world.
Right.
But there's not a... it's not a character in the book who is the narrator, you know.
Oh, so, okay.
Anyway.
Sounds modern.
It is modern, but it's become such a commonplace that
it's become a norm.
Yeah. But no, I've always kind of been a little horrified by science fiction novels where the characters are augmented apes or dolphins or, you know.
But Planet of the Apes is a great movie.
Well, but that's different. That's like they discover, mm-hmm. you know, a bunch of humans discover a planet where, you know, where the characters are evolved apes.
Oh, they didn't evolve into humans. They remained apes. And
They are actually chimpanzees and gorillas, you know, that are
living together.
They're like this is how. Okay, so Pierre Boulle's novel, the novel for Planet of the Apes, Pierre Boulle, it's actually really good.
It's a good novel.
I read it a long time ago. Mm-hmm. It was great source material, and it's worth reading as a novel. It's an allegory about race relations and militarism and the police state and all this, and,
right.
You know, but it's this is not that. This is science fiction where humans have messed around with dolphins' DNA or something, and now they raised their intelligence slightly, and now they can talk and communicate and type on keyboards and stuff like that, you know. Mm. But you're always then in the dolphin's point of view now in this chapter, and I'm like, I really don't care about the dolphin's point of view, honestly.
As long as it's not in my tuna.
This is just endless, and it's just annoying. Yeah. And there's three other plot lines I'm trying to follow too.
Now the dolphins
are swimming around, and they're joking with each other, and they're mocking each other's appearance, and they're talking about this sexy female dolphin that's, you know, in heat now. And I'm like, just kill me, my God.
Wait, so this is the 10th grade with the dolphins?
Jeez, they are like 10th
dolphins
grade.
In 10th grade.
Yeah. Yeah, wearing their, you know, Jordache jeans or something. No,
Jordache flippers.
Jordache flippers. I don't know.
Did you see her flippers? Oh, my God. Is she wearing that?
Anyway, so the reason I'm reading this is it's an alien first contact story, right?
Oh, first contact stories are fun.
Yeah, except this is dragging all the, like, draining all the fun and excitement out of what ought to have been a 400-page max
page turner
first contact page turner right by chopping it up with
dolphins
Wikipedia from the year 2040 and a bunch of extraneous narrative about
adolescent
intelligent
dolphins.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And, you know, so anyway, I get really sick of this intercutting, because the net effect is you cease to care about any of the individual stories, because in another 10 pages, you're going to leave it behind, you know.
Right. Pick it up later or something.
So, anyway, I didn't mean to get onto.
Well, I wonder what you're reading. As usual, I'm not reading anything.
Yeah.
Well, I'm still working through my pattern-making book.
Okay. No, this book, I'm frustrated with this book because it's taken me forever. It's taken me weeks and weeks to get even halfway through it.
Oh, yeah.
And I can usually, I mean, I usually was finishing basically a book a week.
Yeah.
And that's sort of was my average for the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
Picking up a book like this that's taken me like 3 weeks to get halfway through it. Is really
a slog.
It's a slog, and it's not only that, just that it's messing with my average, because it's not shouldn't really be about my numbers,
but
right?
Numbers, man. It's about
numbers. But it's about it's more like I'm feeling like I'm into this now. I should finish it because I'm curious about the first contact story.
Mm-hmm.
But I really feel like I wasted a lot of reading time on this book when I could have used that time.
For other books.
I could have been reading The Conquest of Bread, you know. I could have been reading...
Maybe you just put it down and pick up The Conquest of Bread.
I know. I kind of get, you know, when you've passed the halfway point, you're like, well, you know, I should finish it.
It's just downhill.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm well along. I'm actually working on a pattern for a skirt.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll turn it to clothes eventually. That'll be exciting.
You've got a seed catalog here with you.
Oh, it's the same. It's the same seed catalog. I've just been marking it up. I don't really have anything new.
Well, are there some things you've found that you're excited about ordering?
Other than the corn, let me see. I think there's the peppers. I want to get ground cherries again. They have two kinds this year.
Ground cherries were really fun.
Yeah, the children loved them, but didn't like eating them nearly as much as I did.
Yeah, we got them so the kids would just eat them. When they were out playing, they would just like pull them off the vine and eat them.
And I like to pull them off the vine.
Yeah, and throw them at each other.
Drop them everywhere. The nice thing about ground cherries, though, is that those become new plants.
Well, yeah, but we don't want them everywhere.
Everywhere, all the time. Now, there's Aunt Molly's ground cherry, which a lot of people maybe know about. There's also the Lowen family heirloom, which is slightly different, a little bigger, a little juicier.
The ones we had before were a very pretty sort of pale yellow in the little paper wrappers.
Yeah. Yeah, they look like they're like Chinese lanterns, but edible. And then I told you about the blue corn.
They were great as a little supplement for something. Like, you wouldn't eat a pile of them, but you would throw them into a salad. Yeah,
I really liked them.
And then as you're eating the salad, you come across these little flavor explosions that were very pleasant to eat.
Oh, a little sweet one. Ooh, another sweet one. Yeah, I already mentioned the black Aztec corn and the blue jade corn. One's a sweet corn. I think that's blue jade. Is that right? My glasses. I need to take them off because I'm there. I'm at that point.
You're there. Oh yeah, you had a birthday.
Oh, do you have to bring that up?
Sorry, that keeps happening.
Keeps happening. Oh yeah, the blue jade is a sweet corn, and the black Aztec is a flint corn, which Veronica and I are going to grind and make tamales out of.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Yeah. So that's the plan with the corn, and then there's ground cherries. I think that may be it. I just started some strawberries.
Okay.
Which I had. Yeah. That's I'm growing greens and some berries. I'd like to plant a bunch of trees, frankly, but I'm not sure where I'm going to get trees from yet.
Yeah. We don't really have a big budget for the garden this year either.
No, we don't. But, you know, it's okay. We'll make it.
Yeah. So, okay.
So that's where I'm at. Do we want to take a little sponsor break?
Oh, yeah. We have a sponsor.
That's right. Yeah, okay.
So I've got some wording from our sponsor here. Even an alpha male can have an off day. A female may admire your thick, luxurious coat from a distance, but it's a different story when she gets up close if it's dry, thinning, and flaky. They're going to run into the forest howling. That's why there's silver That's why there's Silverback brand back hair conditioner. Just rub in a little Silverback after you've shampooed your back, and that back hair will come out shiny, smooth, and luxurious without that annoying back dandruff. Sorry. It's also guaranteed to kill lice on contact, so your maid doesn't need to spend her evenings picking off parasites. And it has a fresh eucalyptus scent.
That sounds like a great sponsor. Have they been with us longer?
No, brand new.
Brand new.
That's right. Ask for it by name. Silverback brand back hair conditioner. Available wherever fine hair care products are sold.
Wow. I'll be looking for that.
Okay. Did you want to mention the candle mass?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, mention the candle mass before we...
So candle mass is a traditional Catholic feast, and it's been around for a long time. Many sort of traditional leaning Catholics celebrated as the end of Christmas. Yeah. Christmas actually ended weeks ago on the liturgical calendar and always has. But a lot of people keep their lights up and, you know, do small sacrifices for Christmas until February 2nd.
Okay.
Which is the feast of the presentation of Jesus at the temple. It's like 40 days after Jesus was born, his parents, Joseph and Mary.
He developed really fast.
That's not that, not that the temple. They brought him as a baby.
Not where he shows up and starts arguing with all the scholars.
No, that's later.
Okay.
So this feast, Candlemas, is you bring any statues of Jesus you might have?
Yeah, so this was a Spanish Mass, and of course the people attending were mostly Hispanic. And a number of people brought these very cool little statuettes.
Of the infant Jesus.
Yeah.
It's still celebrated widely throughout Latin America.
Yeah, it was pretty cool to see. And they did a blessing.
For all the statues. You can bring your candles too if you have holy candles.
To
be blessed for your home. And there was a Spanish Mass, which I always appreciate because it sort of allows me to experience life as an Hispanic Catholic in the United States.
Yeah, you were commenting that our inability to understand the Mass was largely the experience that a Hispanic Catholic would have had for decades. In most parishes, trying to attend Mass and being able to understand only a fraction of what was being said.
Some little pieces of it here and there. Which, for my part, I know everyone thinks I'm just an old fuddy-duddy, is why I strongly advocate for saying the Mass in Latin. Because if you grow up and learn the Mass in Latin...
Because no one understands it then.
No, because then everyone understands it. If all Catholics say the Mass in Latin...
If all Catholics learn the Mass in Latin...
Then anywhere you go, wherever you go...
When you go to a Latin Mass, is the homily in Latin too?
No, that's Latin Rite. That's Tridentine Rite.
That's where they really do everything in Latin.
Yeah.
Yeah, because So I have to say, years and years ago, I had... a lot of Spanish in high school and a lot of Spanish in college. I could understand Spanish moderately well. I wasn't great at speaking it. I wasn't fluent. But, especially not a native speaker at high speed, at full speed, you know. But I could read Spanish pretty well. But going to this thing, I realized that was a long time ago. And I could understand next to nothing.
Right.
I could understand words and phrases. The priest gave some kind of a little anecdote at the end, right before everyone left for the potluck dinner afterwards.
Right, there was dinner afterwards.
And it sounded to me like he was telling a little anecdote and people were laughing at it. And I think it had something to do with a family reunion and a dog that was running around licking everybody. But I could be completely wrong about what it was about.
Could have been about any number of things. And
I may have misunderstood completely.
I didn't even get that much.
Yeah.
I understood the Mass part, but that was it.
I understood the Mass parts. And there were a few phrases like... palabra, is word. So I was talking to Josh, kind of muttering to Josh about how that meant word of God, and stuff like that. But so much I didn't unpack.
Yeah.
And the homily was entirely in Spanish.
So
it was billed as a bilingual Mass, but actually only a few phrases were ever in English.
Yeah. Well, a lot of times we describe Masses as being bilingual. And there's a few phrases in Spanish.
Right.
And almost all the Masses in English.
Yeah, almost the only things that were said in English were the intentions. And the intentions were bilingual. The person reading the intentions would say them both in Spanish and English.
But So I found it very gratifying in that respect to empathize.
Kids were kind of... bored out of their skulls.
That's actually why I let Bilby hold his lit candle for so long.
Yeah.
Because I knew it was going to be a long haul for him. But he did, I only had to leave once with him. He did pretty well.
Yeah, he did pretty well.
Yeah, there was dinner afterwards.
There was a lovely potluck dinner afterwards, and they were serving six different kinds of tamales. Oh, I had to really work hard to restrain myself, and I only tried three of the types. I only ate like 2.5 tamales.
Yeah. But there was a good fruit bar.
Yeah.
And
about all these pastries.
All these, yeah. What are those pastries? The those little round pastries. They had them cut in half.
Yeah, I don't know what they're called. They're round pastries, and they're like painted with this like dusty stuff.
Yeah, it's like
it's not powdered sugar.
It's like colored powdered sugar, but thicker and
yeah.
Kind of like a cross between icing and powdered sugar.
Yeah, I honestly don't know what it is. They're very tasty.
Yes, Veronica loved them.
Yeah.
It's like there's one left.
We have to make those.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get the last one, Mom.
All right. They must have a name. They also had hot chocolate and some sweet rolls that were like dulce de leche flavored, like caramel flavored, that were
pretty yummy.
Really good. So,
yeah.
Of course, the kids filled up their plates with
M&M's
and these soda. Pastries.
Well, yeah, the pastries and soda.
Yeah, and I was desperately trying to.
How about food, guys? What do you think about food?
But it was nice.
It was nice.
Yeah.
It was. It's always fun to see kids running around in the PAC.
Yes.
Yeah, that's always a pleasure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Candlemas. And was there, I feel like there was something else. Oh, I didn't try any of the chocolate because it all had milk in it. And I was,
You've been reacting a lot to milk lately. You've been avoiding it.
Yeah, I've been avoiding it largely, but man, it smelled great.
Yeah.
It really smelled good.
It was pretty good. All right.
Yeah. So
we are not really well organized tonight.
Are we ever?
We have been. Yeah, I've had entirely written out pieces to read.
That's true.
And
we've had some episodes where outlines we just like clicked though.
Yeah.
Even though we weren't, you know, really super prepped. But we've got a couple of topics.
We've got a couple topics.
We're going to return to just talk, I guess, used as a jumping off point last week's essay from the weeds about their divorce.
Yes.
And then we've got another piece for all of our sci-fi fans and beyond.
And beyond. Okay, so the weeds, if you recall, Latter-day Saint couple who where the man what was that, 10 years ago?
It was just 5 years ago. They'd been married 10 years, 5 years
ago. Okay, 5 years ago the man came out publicly as a gay man, and
they came out as a couple, as a married couple.
They came out as a married couple that was going to try to stay together as a married couple and live as a married couple.
A mixed orientation marriage.
And that was a new phrase to me at the time. I mean, you know, it's not a new thing. Of course, this happens all the time.
Sure.
But I mean, to be like open and vocal about it,
right,
seemed unusual. Like a bit of a new thing to me, especially in the LDS community.
Yeah.
So then last time we talked about how they had announced that they were divorcing.
Yeah.
And you read the whole 15-page.
I read the whole 15-page essay.
And which we hadn't really finished for last time, and so you had some further thoughts.
Yeah, and I noticed then, and I think I mentioned it last week, that I was a little curious about the way she was talking about romance and how critical it was for a healthy marriage, and how she seemed to be talking about something that was not sexual, but romantic, but was critical for a healthy marriage.
She was writing about passion in their marriage and how she didn't feel she needed to leave her husband because of like a lack of sex
and
the fact that he could no longer like perform heterosexual intercourse with her.
Right.
But it was about not looking at her with smoldering passion in his eyes.
And desiring her.
And Grace and I were looking at each other, kind of saying,
well, that's not going to be there if you're not doing the sex thing.
That's like, it's like they were speaking a language that they were claiming has extra words in it that we've never found actually any use for.
Right.
Or that have any meaning.
Right. And also, I guess what really bothered me about it was, A, it sounded like she was talking about this in-between thing, right?
Yes.
Where I'm well acquainted with sexual romance.
Yes.
And I'm well acquainted with platonic romance.
Yes.
And she's talking about some third other thing.
Yes.
And then, this is the part that got to me, claiming that it's a universal need.
Right.
That you got to have this. Right. You just got to have this. And I think it's entirely fair and appropriate and good and right for her to claim that for herself and say that I need this. I need
but
this.
But that's fair. But I think we were also still having a hard time trying to pin down exactly what that was.
What even this thing is.
And I made some notes here. This is from Sojourner Magazine. Mm-hmm. This is an article I'll put in the show notes that talks about the traditional Greek words for different kinds of love.
Yes.
That have sort of endured over the centuries.
Endured and animated our thinking about.
As concepts. Like, right. we're familiar with Eros, mm-hmm. and agape.
And philia.
But there are a few more. So mm-hmm. Eros is sexual passion or desire, and it's considered fiery and dangerous. You
the
know,
hots. Yeah.
It can break up marriages destroy communities. And,
just burn the village, you know.
Yeah.
That's Eros.
Philia, deep friendship that in ancient times developed between comrades who fought together on the battlefield. And that has to do with loyalty and sacrifice, shared experience, and sharing emotions.
Yeah.
Right. There's agape, which is love for everyone. This is considered the highest love. A caritas, or charity, mm-hmm. also translated. It's considered the highest form of Christian love. It's also embodies empathy for strangers,
yes,
right? Empathy
right.
for all living things.
All living things. It's like the love that God has for all.
Yeah.
You know, that's agape.
So it's considered the most godlike. When you're experiencing agape love, you're closest to how God loves the world.
Mm-hmm.
Ludus, which is... Didn't even know this was considered a form of love, but they described ludus as playful love between young lovers and children that are teasing, flirting, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Very flirtatious, like often unconsummated flirtation.
Oh, right, right.
And the article describes it as like if you go out and spend the evening dancing with strangers at a bar. That can be kind of this ludus.
Right.
And if there's no expectation, you're actually going to go home with any of them. So,
right, right.
There's one called pragma or pragma.
Mm-hmm. It's not pragmatic, is it?
Pragmatic. Long-standing love in married couples. Quote, standing in love, unquote. It's about compromises, patience, and tolerance, basically doing what it takes to be together and support each other for the long haul.
That's what I'm talking about.
Sort of a less passionate mm-hmm. form of love. And then one called philosia, self-love. And two varieties. There's narcissism, which is considered negative.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also a form of loving yourself that's considered more positive. When reading the description, I think of it as self-respect.
Right.
Self-respect and self-understanding that then allows you to meet your own needs and then go forth and love other people.
Right.
You
right.
know.
Which is really quite healthy.
Yeah.
And important.
So, of these six, what the hell is she talking about?
I don't know.
It seems to me, you mentioned like Disney love, right?
The way she described it to me, I heard like the sort of Prince Charming Disney
right.
Romantic love.
And to me, that is like what you might call a crush or mm-hmm. being in love with love or being in love with an ideal instead of a person. And and it always seemed to me that, I mean, I've been there when I had crushes, mm-hmm. you know, when I was quite young. But that always seemed like something you would grow out of.
Yeah, well, and this is the other element to it. So I mentioned how it seemed a little weird to me that, like, yeah, I don't know what this is. But also, there's this element which is, well, no, this isn't a sexual thing.
Right.
And then she describes the sexy stuff.
Right.
Like passion, you know, looking with passion, desiring, wanting.
And I don't understand exactly what she's talking about and or why it would be a bad thing to acknowledge that as sexual.
I'd like a sexual romance.
Right.
It's not a bad thing to like or want or be interested in finding, but she says repeatedly that this is not a sexual thing. It's not about the sex.
I just don't quite understand it. The other thing that you mentioned that I just had to laugh about is that I didn't realize that both of them were apparently counselors.
They were both marriage and family counselors, yes.
Yeah. And
I'm not going to offer any further comment on that.
Anyway.
It seems like an unusual thing.
It seems like they're just spinning as fast as they can to talk themselves into trying to keep their marriage together in a way that they can live with.
Yeah. I should also give the summary because you hadn't finished reading it. I did read the whole thing.
Yeah.
And what it sounds like, and I remember last week we were talking about how it always feels like a death to us when a marriage ends.
Yes.
It has that dimension to it.
Yeah.
And death of possibility and so many other things. But all that aside, right? It doesn't actually sound to me like they're ending their marriage. It sounds like they're going to stop having sex with each other.
Yeah, or trying to.
Right. It sounds like he's not interested in that anymore. Full stop.
Yeah.
And she's not going to force him. So it sounds like they're ending the sexual part of their marriage. And it sounds like they're ending the legal part of their marriage.
Yeah.
And nothing else about their marriage is going to change. They're going to continue to live together, to raise their children together. They're just not going to date
other people. Well, didn't you say they were going to have other people live in their house with them?
Well, they said that ultimately their hope is that they would have a home together with their children, and they'd welcome partners to that home, like a place for all of them to live.
Yeah.
And let me be more specific. Okay. They're imagining this as a homestead, so maybe like two separate buildings.
I see.
But, you know, and they each live in their own building, or, you know. It's not clear. It doesn't exist yet.
Yeah.
But that's the idea. They'd be one household, regardless of, you know, and where who sleeps where is another story. But they're one household.
I just, you know, I kind of followed a bit about the poly community when that was becoming a thing online.
Yeah.
There way back when there were news groups, there was a thing called alt polyamory. Mm-hmm. Which was a place where the subculture of polyamorous folks worked itself out and developed into a culture.
Yes.
With its own sort of set of internal rules and logic. And I was never really interested in that as being my thing. But it was interesting to me to see it kind of work out as a lurker.
Mm-hmm.
And to see them develop sort of a set of principles and rules and norms as to how a household like that might function.
Right.
And I don't think these folks are being honest enough with themselves about their own needs or mature enough to actually walk open-eyed into a poly household.
And they're not even calling it that.
Right.
They're not calling it that.
Right. Because it takes particular people who are not deeply jealous people, mm-hmm. who are mature and stable and most important, I think, very self-reflective.
Mm.
And have mm-hmm. the ability to watch their own emotional state and meet their own emotional needs and not just suppress things until they blow up.
Yeah. I think it's much more cultural than that. There are cultures in which either polyandry or polygamy are
polygamy or so
our norm, our cultural norm, supported culturally and socially, and has all these sort of like what I like to call soft supports. Yes. You don't even realize they're there.
Yeah, right, right.
And you don't need any kind of like special person to do that. It's just what's done.
Well,
you know,
I think if you're going to voluntarily enter a polyamorous community in
the United States,
whatever, in the United States, you should have that cultural backing.
Yes.
You should, but you also should be self-aware enough to know whether this is going to be right for you emotionally, whether it's actually going to work.
It'll be good for you.
And right. You shouldn't just be doing it because it represents some kind of ideal that you aspire to.
Right. Well, and I think I want to just be very clear. They are not describing this for themselves as a polyamory.
Exactly.
That's not how they self-describe. That's not how they self-identify.
Yes.
They're getting a divorce, and they're finding other partners, and they're going to live in the same household.
Well, okay.
Now,
somehow, yeah. I feel like they're hoping for a... They don't... The thing is, that's like an immature view of polyamory.
Yeah.
Which is you want to be able to break up without losing anything.
Yeah.
Right? That's sort of like a... That's, to me, that's like the childish view of it. Yeah, you can like date everyone and you never have to break up, right?
And it's okay. There's no like breakups.
Because you just switched from, you know,
one
sort of primary partner to another. That's kind of insulting to that community, and there's actually a lot more to it than that, you know?
And I also think they have some taboos around polyamory. Yes. LDS folks. I mean, I've got some taboos around polyamory, right?
I think that's
the reason they can't call it what it is. Or
they can't call it what it is, but it's also because of the tradition of polygamy in their culture. It makes more sense to them to lean towards this than some other arrangement.
Some other arrangement, right.
So, I don't know. The more I think about it, the more I just think, this is just not... You know,
kind of scratching your head, but you know the thing that really came through for me. I want to end my conversation about them on a mostly positive note, because I think writ large, it mostly is positive. There's a few like things that don't make sense to me and seem quirky that I just flatly don't understand.
I mean, to be clear, I wish them all the best in the world. I hope they can make their lives work out and be very positive for themselves, but
and their children.
But right. I just really, like you say, I'm scratching my head as to how this is going to get them there.
Well, yeah. I think the way I described it with one of my friends this week that I was reflecting on this with, the two of them are clearly best friends with each other.
Yeah, to have gone through all this.
Yeah, they're very close.
Yes.
They've been best friends, I think, since high school.
Sure.
And care deeply for each other and clearly love each other very much and love the children they share very much. And that's not trivial. That's not trivial at all.
No, and it's not something that, I'm not advocating that they throw it away in some sense.
Right, yeah. And I don't think they should either. And I don't know what they should do. I'm not them. I'm not there. But I think they have the tools to get to where they need to go. I'm, like I said, scratching my head a little bit, but I think they'll get somewhere. And I think everyone will be loved and cared for in the process.
I am not so optimistic.
Yeah.
Because I think to get to where they are hoping to get to, I don't think they can go there with the cultural toolkit that they're carrying around in their heads. And the biggest piece of that cultural toolkit is, for them, it sounds like, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Yeah, yeah. Because
right.
they want to assume, thinking about something he said about there's certain things you can't choose about your life and yourself. Right?
Yes.
Which, I'm all there for that. There are things that you can't choose. And he says, but he can choose to continue to be a member of the LDS Church. He can continue to live his life with his family and so on.
It's clear from their kind of impassioned writing in both their famous blog posts that this is very, the church is very, very important
to them. It's absolutely critical to them. It's central to them. And I think they're finding a path or trying to forge a path as loyal opposition. There are many Catholics like this who agitate fervently for, say, women's ordination or any number of things in the Catholic Church.
Okay.
And they go to Mass every week. They're committed. They're on the altar society. They're there. They're there for it. And they are very committed Catholics who understand themselves as loyal opposition, who want to make a prophetic call to the church to do things differently.
Uh-huh.
And I think they're trying to forge a path like that for themselves. And I don't know the interior landscape of the LDS.
Yeah.
There may be others within the church structure to welcome them and support them.
Maybe.
Because okay. I think if there is that, because there's all these structures, there's like...
They're not going to Mormex it.
I don't think there'll be any Mormex it. Did you just say that? Mormex it?
Well, I was thinking of Demex it, like how, you know, people's like, well, if you're a leftist, you should be fighting to move the Democratic Party to the left. And like, I'm a Demexiter at this point. Demexiter,
leaving. I never joined, but that's right. Another story for another day. No, I think there's so there's America magazine in the Catholic Center, and then there's this Commonweal.
America is specifically Jesuit.
It's a Jesuit Catholic magazine, and people describe it as leftist or communist or I don't know what, but they're actually pretty.
I've never thought of it that way.
It's really just kind of like white bread American Catholicism.
Yes.
It's not anything more radical than that. Commonweal, on the other hand, is like where the loyal opposition goes to read.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then there are these
instead sort of going to Mass.
No, they go to Mass. These people go to Mass.
Okay. All right.
Because, you know, they're not going to... Basically, they're not giving up the church. No one's going to take the church from them. They're going to stay.
No one's going to take the church from them.
Right. That contingent in Catholicism has their own magazines. They know how to find each other. They, you know, the Peace and Justice Committee is where they like to lurk at church, just if you're looking for these folks, maybe at your local Catholic church.
Yeah, there must be a Peace and Justice Committee.
There's a Peace and Justice Committee. That's where you'll find them. Or like if you see, you're looking online, you're trying to find a church, there's no loyal opposition at that parish if there's no Peace and Justice Committee.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah,
good to know.
Yeah, little tips here. It's kind of like when you go to a new town and you go to the health food store and you look at the bulletin board and you find out all the stuff going on. It's like that. There may be some equivalent in the LDS church where there's like a little coffee club of loyal opposition, and there's a place where they can go so they can remain in the LDS church and still get the community that nourishes you.
I really can't say. It seems like
that's what I can't say.
It seems like a very oppressive paternal organization to me. Hey. But you know what? Just like I used to lurk on alt polyamory because I was intrigued by this culture, you know, even though I knew it was not going to be right for me. I lurk on the ex-Mormon Reddits. Sometimes.
Oh, the ex-Mormon Reddit.
And they're fascinating, to say. There's a lot of people. A
lot of ex-Mormons.
Yeah, talking.
Yeah. Talking trash.
Not trash. Yeah. Many of them are still deeply faithful.
Yes, yes.
That's sort of kind of part of what, you know, just like I admire in some sense what the polyamory folks were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
I really admire people who are still faithful, but are, like you say, loyal opposition.
Loyal opposition. Don't have a space there anymore.
That kind of fascinates me. People who are clearly so, you know, have so much faith in the church they were brought up with that they can't just shut it off.
They can't shut it off. They can't walk away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, religious tradition becomes part of you.
Yeah.
It literally becomes a part of you. And so I think there's very possibly, I think it's more likely that they will have a showdown with the LDS church than they will with their family.
Yeah, I think probably true.
Yeah. I don't know how that's going to work out in the end. And I don't want to predict or anything. And I do wish them all the best. I just I'm still scratching my head a little
bit. Definitely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, there's more.
There's more.
Picard and Dathan at Eladrell.
So, this was... we've been watching, rewatching for the most part, episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Mm-hmm.
This is the thing about being a parent is if there's media that you grew up with or that you admire from... You know, either your childhood or your young adulthood. In this case, it would be my young adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
You get a chance to share it with your kids, and then you experience it all over again.
Yay!
And so, one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek: The Next Generation, and I remember vividly watching it with some friends of mine a year or two after I moved to Ann Arbor.
Right.
I had a get together with some coworkers to watch Star Trek. This is an episode, yeah. This is an episode called Darmok.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to really summarize the whole thing. It's pretty famous.
It's pretty famous. And the summary's a bit involved.
Picard is having first contact with an alien race.
They've been previously thought to be unintelligible.
No one can understand what they're saying.
Right.
Because they just speak in these phrases that don't have any meaning to the people coming to visit them.
Right.
And the crew of the Enterprise finally determines that what these people are saying are basically stock phrases or allegorical phrases from their myths and legends.
Right. So not even phrases necessarily, but like really short little summaries, references.
Yeah.
Like so-and-so and that thing. You know?
So even what to call this kind of communication is disputed.
And it's a good open question.
In the show, they refer to it as...
Metaphor.
Metaphor. You also might think of some of it as tropes, like TV tropes.
I think Council Troy refers to it as imagery or images.
Imagery, right. Yeah. You might call them allegories.
Yep.
Or you might call them memes if you're into internet culture now.
I'd call it a meme, really.
So an example of the story, a real quick version of the story, is that in one of these planets past, there were two folks. They sailed across the sea, and they arrived on an island. They arrived separately. So it's Darmok on the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jalad on the ocean. Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra, which is the island. Yep. And then the beast at Tanagra. There's some kind of a horrible monster on the island.
Right.
And then Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra fight the beast. They defeat the beast. And then Darmok and Jalad on the ocean. They leave together.
Right.
So that's a capsule summary of something that might in its fullness look like what's the story?
The story of Gilgamesh.
Epic of Gilgamesh.
I look like the Epic of Gilgamesh, right. Or like Beowulf.
Beowulf or a Greek, Greek myth.
Like, so it's a full story, right?
Yeah.
But you can reference, so you know, they went to the island together.
Right.
Right? Or, they left the island together.
Yeah, Penelope and Hades or
Penelope
whatever.
Hades,
When Picard meets the captain
of the alien vessel.
They're talking over their view screens, mm-hmm. and this alien captain, Dathan, is arguing with his first officer. Yeah, they're right. trying to figure out what to do, and the captain keeps saying, "No, Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra," and the first officer's like, "No, don't do that."
Don't
and the captain insists, and then they steal Picard. Picard is dematerialized via transporter by the alien ship from the bridge and sent down to the surface of this planet with the captain.
With the other captain.
With the other captain. And then this alien ship, they turn on some kind of scrambling field so that the Enterprise can't use its transporters. So they can't send anyone down. They can't communicate. Oh, Joshua is bringing the baby down.
Oh, baby.
Baby girl. So I'll keep talking.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can get her to nurse something like that.
Something like that. I think that's why she's here.
That's why she's here.
Oh, it clearly is.
Anyway, so Picard and the captain are now on this planet's surface, and the captain, the Thon, keeps offering Picard a knife, and he thinks Picard thinks that this means that D'Thon wants to challenge him to a battle.
Challenge him to a duel or some kind of...
And he's not into that. He keeps dropping the knife and saying, I'm not going to fight you. And D'Thon is like, rolling his eyes, like, come on, why can't he understand? And then this monster shows up. And Picard eventually realizes that he has to pick up the knife.
The knife is for me to fight
the monster. And they have to fight together because this monster is too big for either one of them to defeat alone.
Right.
And so then they talk strategy using more metaphors, allegorical phrases from
their past.
From their past and all this. And they eventually figure out how to communicate. However, D'Thon is badly injured
in the fight.
In the fight, while the Enterprise is trying to beam up Picard, he can't fight for a few minutes, a couple critical moments, and D'Thon is badly injured and he can't help. And then D'Thon eventually dies. But
the sacrifice he made.
The sacrifice he made meant that Picard now could speak to the people on this ship.
Right.
They've made first contact.
Right.
And so their legend...
Now includes
Picard and D'Thon at El Adrell.
Yeah.
Right. So this is all about, to me, how our shared stories allow us to communicate with each other.
Right. Yeah, that you can't communicate with someone that doesn't share your stories.
And so, you know, I've read Greek myths. I'm reading the kids' Norse myths. I grew up with these myths. I grew up with the Bible, you know, not just a little Bible, but a lot of the Bible, a lot of Bible study. Mm-hmm. Beowulf, you know, and the Tolkien, and you know, everything. It all feeds into the hopper.
Right.
And having lived together and read together and spoken together for so many years, Grace and I have a huge
shared repository of
stories that we can reference, even to make dumb jokes.
Yeah.
About
the best kind of dumb joke.
About gorilla back hair conditioner. Or whatever.
Yeah, whatever it might be.
So I'm getting somewhere with this, which is that, you know, it used to be only, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
When most people watch broadcast TV.
Mm-hmm.
You know how many people tuned in to watch the last episode of MASH?
Oh, yeah. I did.
It was a huge thing. It's
huge. Right.
And most Americans shared that experience of watching that.
Yeah.
I don't know about most, but...
A lot of Americans.
A lot of Americans.
A lot of culturally similar Americans.
Yes.
Shared that experience.
Right. So, if you could say, Hawkeye on the bus in Korea. Yeah.
People like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And really, you have a shorthand now.
Yes.
For communicating a lot of information.
Yes.
Almost like instantaneously. Like you bring that image and the experience of the image to mind.
Right.
Just by triggering...
The emotional content, too.
All the emotional content is right there by recalling that shared experience.
Yes.
So, that shared story.
So we're now in this sea of narratives.
Yeah.
But we're not sharing them.
No, we're not. No, the
and we're in silos. We're all in our little tin cans watching
silos.
One narrative. It's the associative mating of people, you know, into their little silos where, like, oh, well, we were watching Game of Thrones. Oh, or we were watching House of Cards. Oh, we were watching this other thing. Right. Oh, you know, we were watching Fox News.
Well, and you kind of like... It's self-feeding. Like, you ask the people in your silo, so what are you watching?
Yes.
And they tell you what they're watching.
And then you go watch it.
And then you go watch it.
Yeah. Assortative mating, so, you know, self-selection. Mm-hmm. Right. So there are a lot of factors here. One of the big ones is the decline of broadcast television.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and frankly, the complete breakdown of any kind of shared knowledge base among Americans.
Knowledge and even religious education.
Yeah, it's all broken and gone.
And then that also was accelerated by the demolition of the Fairness Doctrine. under the Reagan administration, where news outlets don't feel obligated to avoid the appearance of bias.
Right. They have no obligation to that. And say whatever they want to pander to their base that pays for the advertising.
Yeah. And so even older and more reputable and venerable media sources basically now have this tendency, and here's where I'm going with this, to turn themselves into stenographers.
Oh, right.
So there's an article that appeared in BBC, BBC News. The Paul Simon city that turned to Trump.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I saw that one.
This is about Saginaw. Mm-hmm. So this is the thing. The New York Times now interviews Nazis because, well, their point of view is important to share with the world, right?
Right.
And
Nazis have thoughts, too.
You know, and the BBC now sends correspondents to Rust Belt cities in the middle of Michigan to ask everyone what they think.
So what do you think? Well, which, frankly, as someone who used to live there, I always thought they should come find out what people there think and how the world should be from folks that are places that are forgotten and overlooked. But I'm not quite sure that's what they were doing. At least not the spirit that I was thinking, imagining it.
It's a strange article because it's just sort of a profile. But it seems to me that in the course of profiling
you would contextualize
these folks, you would contextualize it. So there is some context given.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sort of broken up into two groups of people. There's the Trump supporters and the Democrats. They quote people from both groups.
Right.
But there's no, they don't interact, right?
Oh,
and the correspondent doesn't interact. No
they
one's
just
pushing
asked.
Back. They're just, it's, there, I guess this counts, they think this counts as balance. Well, let's
balance
talk to some Democrats too.
Right.
But it's just stenography. There's no dialogue. There's no debate. There's no context setting about the ideas that they're.
I think that's the important, that there's no context setting about the ideas, because journalists typically are people who are making a journal entry of what they see.
That's
right. But they also give context and frame what they see, because you have to.
Yeah.
You can't present this as if it's, you can't present an editorial like a news feature.
Right. So this is like this, I want to read a little bit. So they just interview people and then it's very telegraphic. They have a few paragraphs about each person, very short paragraphs. Daryl Wimbley knows he's not a typical Trump supporter. The 49-year-old was born in Alabama to a black mother and Arab father. Growing up, his father spoke to him only in Arabic. At the age of 3, he moved to Saginaw with his mother. And then I skip ahead a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to point out that probably means his father was an immigrant, right? So
yeah.
But skipping down a few lines. After Obama, I didn't care. He says the most racist thing he ever did was voting for Obama. I didn't care what his views were. I didn't care. He was black and that was it. I didn't question it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, that's not just him, but yes.
It's not just him, but it's also not really racist, but anyway.
It's a different sort of meaning of racist.
Well, yeah, it's a kind of bigotry, but go ahead.
Racial solidarity over any other concern, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
After Obama came to office, he did question it, voting Republican for the first time in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And when Donald Trump became a candidate, he listened. He said a lot of things that I thought but would never say in public, he says. Such as, illegal immigrants do cause a lot of crime, he replied. I'm not going to keep going, but then there's a second person, Jim Hines. Jim Hines, a Christian, is not put off by the president's crudeness. It's not how I would express myself, but I think he speaks from the heart. Or his tough line on immigration. To have a sovereign country, you need borders, he said. Immigration, great, but not illegal immigration. He supports the wall on the Mexican border and thinks Mr. Trump's policies, especially the tax cuts, have rejuvenated Saginaw.
Fascinating. I haven't been in like a month or two. I should go back.
Saginaw has lost half its population since 1960.
Yeah.
Something that Saginaw could benefit enormously from would be a huge wave of immigration.
Actually, to be perfectly honest.
Sue Lynn, 63, also admires the president, but her language is more colorful, more Trump-like. Quote, if you've got an infestation of rats, you call the guy to come in, she says. Quote, you don't care if his crack's showing, you don't care if he's swearing, you don't care if he's got tobacco-stained teeth. You want the rats taken out.
Well, there you go.
So, yeah. So I guess they're setting the context and saying she's definitely a little more colorful in her language. But I'd just like to point out that the BBC...
has this woman referring to human beings as rats?
Has given over...
its microphone.
Its microphone, its online presence... to this woman from Saginaw who refers to immigrants as rats.
Yeah.
As vermin. I'm not really comfortable with that. And honestly, I'm not sure what benefit is served by giving Trump supporters more of a platform to anti-virtue signal each other.
Yeah. No, there's... The only benefit is to help them find each other and help them find their story and find out how to communicate with each other and how to signal each other.
So about those stories, I mean, the stories, the memes, the whatnot, you know, mm-hmm. I left a lot of this out. It's quite a long article.
It's a long article.
So like
I think a lot of it we don't want to share. Right.
But, you know, the guy was talking about the same things that Trump was talking about in his State of the Union address. He was talking about criminal gangs of immigrants, you know, right. But referring to these Central American gangs, you know. He talks about this. He talks about criminality. These are the stories that they're sharing.
Well, it's like the Welfare Queen story.
It's like the Welfare Queen story. This is their common language that they have to draw on. And then refer to in shorthand.
Yes.
Right? So like the rats, you know, the mm-hmm. rat catcher, you know. She's really referring to like ICE, right?
Yeah.
But people like me have positive stories in our heads about...
immigration.
Immigrants and immigration. And would point out that the guy who's first quoted, his father was an immigrant. He's... shouldn't feel that he's in a position to attack immigrants.
But his father came here legally. That's the retort.
Yeah, you know.
Not talking about me.
About that. A lot of people say that my ancestors came here legally. You go back far enough and there was no legal.
There's no legal about it.
There was no legal about it. There was no authority
when people
were just showing up. First of all, the emigration was illegal.
Right.
You know, just like...
you just got on a boat and hope
you
made it.
You just got on a boat and you paid a coyote, the equivalent of a coyote...
to sail you across the Atlantic.
In the hopes that you would make it.
In one piece.
And be able to settle here. And there was nobody to, like, stop you mm-hmm. from claiming a piece of dirt...
Except for the folks who were already here.
Except for the folks who were already here, whom you probably were engaged in driving off their land.
Right.
Or killing.
Whichever, you know.
Or both.
I mean, that's one way to drive them off their land, just to kill them. Or sometimes, as they say in the textbooks, they might agree to leave to make room for the settlers.
I was going to cite that as another story, right? We're raising our kids now with textbooks. That say that when the settlers arrived in America, they needed land. The people who were already living there agreed to move to make room for the new settlers.
Wasn't that nice?
Yeah, but the story I have about that...
it's more of a Guns and Steel story.
Well, it's a little thing I like to call the Trail of Tears.
Yeah, that's that story.
That's one of them.
Right.
You know, and so I don't know how to resolve this, but these things were have been sort of slotting together in my head, like, you know, the the idea that we communicate via stories.
Well, that's it's actually kind of a huge thing, and it's a little strange to me that it was such a sci-fi oddity, if you will. Like,
yeah.
Oh, wouldn't this be odd? It's actually the core of how we communicate most effectively. Mm-hmm. The most effective communication is to simply evoke a story that is shared.
Well, I think that was the big, like, sort of conclusion of the episode, is that, you know, the Adarians, are they called Adarians?
Temerians.
Temerians. I'm sorry. The Temerians, they weren't this oddball. They weren't these intellectual oddballs. Right. They weren't defective in some way.
No.
Although they refer to them as having, you know, a different ego structure. But that they actually, like, Picard comes to deeply respect the way they communicate, and he's signaling this by pulling out his copy of Homer.
Right, you know, the Homeric Tales.
The Homeric Hymns, as he, yeah,
points out.
So
yeah, it's, this is, I think, really gets at the heart of what makes human beings human beings.
Yeah, yeah.
The stories we tell. And effectively, this is what's interesting, and this is why I think, at least in the story, in the context of the story, he was willing to die for this first contact. Our stories are how we become immortal.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, really.
He actually has, so the captain kept his own little log in his, their race's pictogram writing. Mm-hmm. Picard took it with him when he left the planet, and he offered it back to the first officer, who, there's a little scene where he quickly beams it over. I mean, sort of visually, it's like he's reclaiming the captain's soul.
Yes.
Right? He's sending it back to his people.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's like you're going to have your heart buried under the linden tree in your home country or something like that. But it's
that.
Yeah. But it's then the first officer reads from it, and he reads this Picard and D'Thon et Eladrel, because the captain, even though he was dying apparently, wrote down the story.
Wrote down the story. Yeah.
For his race to carry on. And I was talking earlier about reading First Contact narrative, right? First Contact narratives are very, you know, important in the history of science fiction. And this was a really effective one.
It was really effective.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Eleanor liked Eleanor it too. Agrees. She liked it.
She's picking up a lot of language, actually. She figures it's her time to talk
she's
now.
She's saying, Veronica and Eleanor at Pittsfield Township.
Those were good times. Yeah.
Yes.
That's a good story.
All right, so I guess we're going to wind this up.
We're going to wind this up here? Okay. What did I add? I have one more thing to say, remember it, about the way stories are in human history, and the way we use them, it's like a form of time travel.
Oh, sure.
Right? Like, yeah. The knowledge and the experience and the things you do and you have in one place at one time can travel forward in history.
Mm-hmm.
When you put it into a story.
But that's also, like, there's a cautionary aspect to that too, which is, yeah, I think we do need to be careful
about what stories you tell.
What stories we tell and what stories we emphasize.
Right. And the stories we just let go away.
You can have a humane story about, you know, America built by immigrants, you know, or you can have an inhumane story about how you're hiring a rat catcher to round up the rats.
You can also have a truthful story.
Yeah. And but
about how America came to be.
But those hateful stories that dehumanize people,
mm-hmm,
those kill.
Yeah. Yeah, they do.
And so we should be cautious
about the kind of stories.
About that kind of story. And I'm not saying we need to censor the BBC. I'm just saying I want to see people write more thoughtfully.
Yeah.
And actually recognize the power they're wielding
with their words.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
That's all for this week, I think.
That's all for this week. We got to take the baby upstairs.
Take the baby upstairs. If you have feedback, stuff you want us to know, let us know.
Yeah, get in touch. you know, you can leave comments on the blog or on YouTube, or you can tweet at me. Grace isn't on Twitter very much, but
am I on Twitter?
You do have a Saginaw something.
Oh,
account.
Yeah, sorry. Oops.
It's not very active.
No, I don't think it's been active since 2011.
Yeah, it's been a while. Okay, everyone. Thank you for listening.
Take care.
Bye-bye.